All statements, views, and opinions are personal and do not represent the United States government, the Department of Defense, or the United States Army. Welcome to the Center for Army Lessons Learned podcast, Insights from the Fight, the podcast dedicated to bringing you lessons learned from exercises, warfighters, and Army fielded forces. I'm your host, Mr. Jeremy Sturmer. Today's guests are members of the 2nd Battalion, 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment from the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. They recently completed a successful rotation to the Joint Readiness Training Center, JRTC, at Fort Polk, Louisiana, and spoke about some of their successes with UAS platoon integration and targeting at the February 2026 Expanded Maneuver Air Summit. Thank you each for being here today. Before we begin, can you introduce your team members and share a brief overview of your military backgrounds leading up to your current assignment?
Yes, sir. I'll go first. This is Major Lucas Ziller from Buffalo, New York, originally. I earned my commission through OCS back in 2010. And since then, I've served under various major commands, including Western Hemisphere Command, SOCOM, and Central Command. I currently serve as the Battalion Operations Officer for 2501 Parachute Infantry Regiment. I was in that role during our most recent JRTC rotation.
Sir, good morning. Captain Jared Rooney, current Battalion FSO for Geronimo 2501. I am from Plymouth, Massachusetts, and I got my commission from Worcester State University in Worcester, Massachusetts. I have been in various positions in my field artillery career, starting with my fire direction officer time at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, then transitioning over into 2nd Brigade here at the 82nd, finishing up Triple C, coming back here.
Morning, Sergeant First Lieutenant Jameson McDonald, commissioned out of Siena College in Albany, New York. I'm originally from Truro, New York. Commissioned as an infantry officer, this is my first operational unit. I've been here at Geronimo for about a year now. I currently serve as the Unmanned Aerial Systems Robotics Systems Platoon Leader, and my current function is to not only mass robotics and autonomous systems and support of maneuver, but also to provide recommendations to the commander as to how to employ those systems as well.
Good morning, my name is Staff Sergeant Jacob Kirkpatrick. I am the UAS Platoon Sergeant here for Geronimo. I've been in the Army for 10 years now. My first duty station was up in Alaska, which is actually where I first qualified on UAS systems. I left Alaska in 2019, came to 2nd Brigade here at the end of 2019, and from there, I was sent to the Master Trainer course for small unmanned systems. Immediately following graduating that course, I stood up a UAS platoon, much like here, 1st-2nd Brigade. My main focus in the job that I currently hold is I'm the technical expert for the systems, and I deal with all of the training across the division on these systems themselves. I'm currently qualified on every Group 1 or small unmanned system that the Army fields as of right now.
Before we jump into discussing how your rotation went at JRTC, I would like to provide an understanding of how the 2nd Battalion 501st took an operational approach to this mission. Major Ziller, tell us how your battalion was organized to fight as you got yourselves ready to go into that rotation.
Of course, absolutely. So first I'll just let everyone know, although we are currently going through the MBCT, Mobile Brigade Combat Team transition, during our lead up to JRTC as well as at JRTC, we were actually still a legacy infantry brigade combat team structure. One significant caveat to that, our brigade commander made the decision to mass certain capabilities with certain battalions, specifically with our ISV fleet, as well as our drone systems. So every battalion in the brigade gave up their ISVs to one single battalion. That allowed that battalion to mass as a mobile battalion. And that really hyper-enabled that battalion's mobility in terms of rapid repositioning around JRTC. Geronimo Battalion, my battalion, was given all the drone systems from across the brigade. That allowed us to enable our kill chain with that proliferation of sensors and drive some lessons on that front. But the lead up into JRTC, first, we had a series of CPXs, command post exercises, to validate our C2 systems. It allowed us, once we got to JRTC, to further integrate our drones and to enable our kill chain so that we could get after some targeting en masse. We also went down to JRTC a couple of months prior for the leader training program, and that allowed our staffs and our processes within our staff to be validated. We had a culminating training exercise here at Fort Bragg to work through our maneuver, work through our systems and processes in a field environment. Coming out of that, we went immediately into JRTC outload.
Lieutenant McDonald and Sergeant Kirkpatrick, obviously the Army is going through transformation and contact. There's a lot of initiatives when it comes to unmanned aircraft systems at different organizations. Using those definitions of whether you're talking small UAS, whether you're talking short-range reconnaissance or mid-range or long-range reconnaissance as being available to the higher echelons, and then loitering munitions, can you talk about the systems that your platoon brought to the battalion as you prepared to train up and then execute your mission?
Yeah, absolutely. So we came to the fight with 42 Skydios, which are a short-range reconnaissance system. And we also came to the fight with the Switchblade 600, which is a loitering munition that is built to penetrate medium armored vehicles. We would launch from behind the flak and then go out anywhere between 2 to 5 kilometers and do reconnaissance and call for fire missions from there. Some of the issues that we would run into while doing that was kind of multiple systems at one time up in the air would cause some interference in the hand controllers if they were too close together. Sir, would you like to fill in anything?
Essentially, we took 11 operators from across the brigade. Each of the PIRs fielded 3 operators for this initiative. We took 96 batteries into the box, as well as the nascent infantry squad vehicle heavy capability through DEVCOM that served as what we call the battery bus, or as our battery recharge station, sir. The limitations that Sergeant Kirkpatrick highlighted also boiled down to battery resupply, and that's something that light infantry formations across the Army see is not only radio batteries and drone batteries, but things like charging our ATACs so that we can all communicate and things of that nature, sir. So that was a nascent capability that we brought to the fight.
Okay. Captain Rooney, I'd like to talk a little bit about the sensor-to-shooter link. What type of effects and capabilities, lethal or non-lethal, that you were going to have access to as you guys kind of prepared for this rotation?
Yeah, absolutely, sir. So coming into this rotation, understanding how many drones we had and the capabilities that they could bring, JRTC approved us to do one-way attack, and we also had droppable munitions as well. So we tried to pair those accordingly with NAIs or known areas of interest. What we found at JRTC was mainly going to be the sensor being that RQ-28 or that Skydio directly to a battalion mortar system, a 120 system, an 81, or company 60s. If we were able to identify high payoff targets, then it would be escalated in that manner. On the fire side, we did a lot of cross-training during our initial lead-up to our Devil Avalanche, or our culminating training event. We were able to take a lot of the drone operators and bring them into our this certification, specifically the Joint Fires Observers course, the JFO evaluation, getting them into the Call for Fire Center, teaching them 3 lines of what generates that call for fire, and giving them a general understanding of like what we're looking for at the battalion fire support element, so that we could try and make this process a little bit smoother.
Okay. Anybody else?
And sir, from my perspective, 2 big ticket items really helped us out. First, integrating drone operation into all maneuver training and all fires training. So it's now a matter of course in 2501, 10 drones to train with the mortarmen when they conduct their mortar certification tables. We send drones to every single situational training exercise lane And that, one, helps solidify and train our kill chain, but two, gets our formation used to a drone-rich environment, which I think anyone looking at Ukraine sees is the way of the future. And then secondly, we simplified our kill chain and to get after more targets. We gave a lot of capability to our HUC company commander, and we gave him capabilities so he could apply in that battle space. For us, that was drones, battalion mortars, and we just said, hey, here's your round allocation that you can use. Here is your commander's priority target list. Get after it. With that commander's intent and guidance and with graphic control measures, that really helped us.
Let's go ahead and jump into the JRTC rotation. As you guys are executing the rotation, describe how you allocated your UAS platforms for the battalion. How much of it was dedicated to information collection, whether that's PIR or other CCIR, and then how much was tasked with supporting the direct sensor to shooter link as you guys were trying to achieve effects against the enemy?
Our brigade commander made the decision to give 2501 all the brigade drones. Our battalion also made the decision to pull all the company drones up to battalion level. So we put all our drone systems into a single platoon at the battalion level. You can think about that as a drone specialty platoon, no different than an AT specialty platoon or a scout specialty platoon. Once we did that and we masked them at the battalion level, we would then give a lot of authority to that HAC commander to run that platoon.
As you kind of looked at the allocations of those UAS platforms, how much did you dedicate toward information collection and answering PIRs for your commander to help his with decision making? And then how much did you allocate to support the shooter to sensor links and to achieve effects against the enemy?
So I can kind of expand upon that.
Okay.
The intent was to get as many drones physically up in the air at any given time. This is where we learned a lot within the first, I would say, 48, 72 hours, is the amount of drones and the tasking for each drone system or the tasking to the SUAS platoon was very minimal. After we got over that 72-hour mark, that's when we really started to give a task to a drone operator to go and look for a specific target or information collection, but it wasn't perfect at the beginning. We were receiving a lot of data from the SUAS platoon. Anything that they would see, they would report it up, but as we continued to move throughout the JRTC box, it became, okay, I need you to go and look and report further out 2 kilometers in front of the plot and let me know what's going on. We're not going to call the fire, essentially, but anything within a 1 kilometer battle space and it's on the high priority target list, then we can go ahead and execute.
Sir, it's Jameson. To your point about what was the allocation to targeting versus ISR, I would say it's about 80% targeting at first and about 20% ISR coverage. We came into the box at roughly P plus 36, essentially had minimal guidance and just ran with it. From there, we got additional guidance and we really began hunting off the commander's high priority target list. The issues we ran into were the mass of sensor data that was being acquired by the drones as they were in the air, and paring that down into what's a high priority target, what do the maneuver companies need to know, and kind of filtering information and getting it to the appropriate channels. That was our biggest, I would say, headache in the first 48 to 72 hours. But once we pared it down into you're hunting specific targets in specific zones, that increased our success exponentially.
I'd like to stay on that subject for just a little bit. Let's talk common operational picture. How you passed what you were seeing as a UAS platoon to your subordinates and maneuver units to enable them to have better situational understanding? And what were your processes that got that information to the maneuver companies?
Essentially, as Major Ziller alluded to earlier, pure legacy systems, voice comms, mostly over TSM. Although, as I'm sure many of us know, TSM in the woods is a little hit or miss, sir. So primarily TSM, FM voice comms, or myself and my platoon sergeant physically going back to the command post and pointing at a map. This is what I saw here. Something that really helped us in this regard is a map system we call the Devil Special, where essentially you break every known terrain feature, whether it's an intersection of a road, a hilltop, some sort of key terrain that you can reference on the ground, and assigning a checkpoint number to it. So essentially, instead of trying to read out a grid when none of us have slept in 3 days and the TSM comms are spotty, I can just say, sir, I saw a column of 4 BMPs going north on this MSR in vicinity of checkpoint Alpha 5-7. And that vastly simplified it once we all kind of got on that model of how we were communicating that information.
And I'd like to continue on that common operational picture, either S3 or FSO. Kind of describe how your CP structure was set out through the rotation. Did the commander operate out of the TOC or the TAC? And then as we talked about the struggles, maybe it was sometimes with digital systems, how much did you rely on analog versus digital to keep the commander informed about decisions and targeting things that you were trying to execute?
Absolutely, sir. This is Lucas. So primarily our commander would operate out of our mobile TAC, especially during high points in the rotation, or fight nights as they're often called. Our TAC is a vehicle, a high back Humvee structure. In the back of that Humvee would be myself, Jared, our first support officer, an S2, commander's RTO, and then commander himself. Further, we put a strong lieutenant as the TAC platoon leader so that the TAC proper could focus on managing the fight and not get lost at the same time. As far as digital versus analog mission command systems, we leaned very heavily on analog systems. We had digital systems up, especially as we were communicating with our higher headquarters and understanding what our adjacent units were doing and the brigade was doing. But for down and in purposes, we went heavy on analog. And to enable that aspect of mission command, we had two overarching priorities. First, shared graphics. So we would make sure that all our graphics were disseminated to the lowest level, that the commander during rehearsals, the commander would personally inspect the platoon leader's graphics to make sure that they were operating off of the latest version of those shared graphics. The next thing I mentioned on those graphics is we proliferated graphic control measures as much as possible. I would tell my AS3s, I want more phase lines, I want more objectives, I want more checkpoints. It all helped out in the end because probably people listening that have experience of trying to talk over voice comms off of a map and just reading off 8-digit grids to each other, it's a lot easier just to reference checkpoint 27 or objective 4 rather than reading those grids off. So it really helped us, you know, having those shared common operating picture really helped. And then the last thing up on the common operation pictures, we had, in any given time, 6 UAS up, observing NAIs and grid squares and the like, and they were seeing things constantly. And the ability to paint that picture of voice comms just is a tremendous gap that we're looking into attempting to close. Being overly reliant on voice comms really hampered us.
Talk about your communication upward to brigade. You're relying on a lot of analog products. Was it a struggle for the staff to take that information and then process it up to brigade? Did you adapt any of those processes during the rotation in order to better keep the operational picture for the higher headquarters informed?
Yes, sir. From the Italian S3 perspective, I had a battle captain that was swivel chairing our maneuver graphics and both our current operation picture as well as our future operation plans from analog products into digital systems that could be that the brigade could then see. Keeping our brigade as abreast as possible of what we were doing was a consistent struggle. Visually depicting that was a lot slower than just getting on to the voice comms or using chat functions to do the same thing. But a picture's worth a thousand words, and we definitely left some words on the table.
All right, I'm going to jump over to Captain Rooney. As we've had this understanding of what your kind of structure was and some of the ISR that you were doing, talk to me about your targeting process, how you anticipated executing the missions, and then how it actually ended up starting to work out once your rotation began.
Yes, sir. So this kind of goes directly into our MDMP process. What we were trying to get after essentially was D3A, decide, detect, deliver, and assess. Bringing in that new ISR asset for us and how that actually it is incorporated and put into the assessed category. Understanding this is an ISRS that they can give us really good BDA and then also do a lot of detection. As we continue to move through JRTC, we transitioned into a more hybrid model with F3 EAD. It's a find, fix, finish, exploit, analyze, and disseminate. Essentially, what we were able to do with our drone is use them in multiple different facets and get them into the battle space quickly for long durations of time and then hand off one drone operator to another. And then just continue to sense going into our target selection standards and then pairing that with the adjudication tables. Being able to use two main products every time we would go out, it was my HPTL and my target selection standards, and then giving that clear guidance to Lieutenant Jameson. If you see two BMPs or a T-72 tank, immediately generate a call for fire and then send it to me. It got really hectic in the TAC at some point, but when I was in the MCP, it made it a lot easier because I had my team, I had my FSNCO, I had my AFSNCO, my assistant fire support officer sit through all the information, and then on the logistics side, go back and start forecasting based off of all of the fire missions that we're generating on a daily basis.
Okay, and one of the things that I know that you guys talked about at the Air Summit was the fact that in the end, you had more targets than you really had the ability to engage. How you might request either general support from your higher headquarters to engage those targets. I'm assuming that was based on their attack guidance matrix as well. But also talk about how you passed that information off to the maneuver units when you weren't going to be able to defeat the system.
Yes, sir. So Jared again. When we were talking up to our higher headquarters, it was very challenging. We were using satellite radio to talk up, and I had that capability with me in our TAC. And then being able to talk that down to the companies was primarily over TSM. If a company FSO identified a brigade HPTL, it was no different than if it was to go to a battalion mortar system. We transmitted through MUOs or through our ICE channels and talking that up to brigade, and then it would get requested to the FA battalion. The FA battalion would shoot it. We would get all of the shot splash transmissions. What we found was it took significantly longer, and if it was in our battle space, after 2 to 3 minutes of target decay time, we would just swivel to our battalion mortars and shoot it with a 120 system and then try and report up. We got so inundated with all of the targets that were in the battle space that we did sometimes miss, like reporting what we were killing up to our higher headquarters.
So as you looked at the implementation of your plan for utilization of the UAS and how you were syncing with targeting and the information collection plan, what were the things that the Op 4 were able to do that created a challenge for your battalion that you had to adjust to during the rotation?
First and foremost, we had to really pay attention to our missions. The Op 4 element down there at JOTC, you know, has the ability to detect our various communication devices. So we had to give a lot of trust to our subordinate leaders and paratroopers that they would have a mission discipline so they couldn't be detected. We also learned that it's vitally important to protect not just the drone itself, but the launch recovery site. Those launch recovery sites are relatively static, so they had to be able to pack up and move in a moment's notice.
Sure, this is Jake. So what Major Ziller said about our maneuverability and constantly moving to survive, I think that is probably what was the hardest for us. In such a target-rich environment, it was really hard for us to be like, okay, we're going to leave these guys on the table, and we have to pick up and move. Just because of how close we were to the flock, I think that was the biggest problem for us.
Okay, do you happen to know whether Op 4 had significant amount of EW capabilities to employ against you?
We're very fortunate to have an attached EW section to our platoon with a tactical electronic warfare system, infantry on an ISV platform. So whenever enemy systems began emitting their jamming capabilities, we were able to detect them. And we actually ended up neutralizing a good portion of their electronic warfare assets with the help of that attached system, as well as having at least 4 to 6 systems in the air at all times.
Before you were able to defeat that system, did you guys develop any SOPs or practices based on encountering some of those systems in the box?
The biggest SOP that we were able to develop using our legacy RQ-28 Alpha systems was terrain referencing the location of the enemy system. For example, in the southern portion of our corridor, we were experiencing a lot of RF interference around one specific area. So we asked our attached EW section to begin scanning our UAS band in that direction. And once they started picking up a heavy signal coming from that area, we essentially loitered right outside what I would call the bubble of a mission defeat from the enemy system's side, and were able to get eyes on that emitter. They're primarily using reactive jamming and mostly jamming purely our UAS signals. But being able to have that RF detect capability kind of narrow down the area where that emitter was located, and then loitering outside that emitter's effective range with the UAS, but still being able to get eyes on and cross-reference terrain, UAS location, azimuth of observation, approximate range, and being able to target those assets, I would say that was the biggest SOP that we came up with.
As you're putting all of these UAS into the area of operations that your battalion owns, what were your procedures for managing that airspace picture and sharing that information with higher headquarters, and then how that affected your ability to bring in either aviation aircraft or to bring fires in on targets?
Essentially, whenever we would pull up to a launch and recovery site, we would request our ROS boxes to be opened. What that did was it allowed us to basically own that airspace as long as we were flying in it. Where we ran into issues was within a certain distance of Geronimo drop zone, while air lands are going on, all of those ROSs are closed. Same for real world medevacs, which I'd say that was our number one limiting factor, was airspace being closed for real world events. Of that 56 hours we were flying, there was another, I would say, probably 48 to 60 hours where we were able to fly, but our airspace was closed. But I can pass it to Captain Rudy.
Okay.
Yes, sir. So for a targeting aspect of it, airspace deconfliction really wasn't that challenging until AH-64 or a rotary wing came on station directly supporting Geronimo 2501. The max awards of our systems was anywhere between 1,000 to 5,000 feet AGL, and we were operating our drones right at 500 feet. So they're talking to Jameson and his team and giving the commanders a better picture of like when drones are in the air was probably one of the most pivotal points. FSOs would call me constantly and ask, is there red hair in our airspace? And that's when I would talk to the UAS platoon and just let them know, like, hey, are we flying in this area? And it was usually a yes. And then I would just call back to the FSO and just let them know, yeah, that's blue air. And then when Rotary Wing was checking on station, I already knew that our UAS platforms were down. So if they had anything in the air, I knew it was red air.
This is Lucas. If I may actually quickly go back to the counter EW fight more broadly, not just countering the Op 4's EW capabilities, but anything that, you know, my commander would deem as a high priority target. Prior to the rotation, another thing that we did was do a very thorough train analysis. We divvied up the JRDC training area and had each company brief their own portion of that so we can get really into the micro terrain, so to speak. And that allowed us to do two primary things. One, it showed us where the enemy was going to be, because the enemy needs certain terrain features in order to apply effects. Just like we need, you know, relatively clear locations to do our own launch and recovery operations, so does Op4. Before we even hit the DZ, we already had targets laid on, NAIs and target area of interest laid on to those expected launch recovery sites. Once we had that, it was just a matter of identifying the enemy maneuver, throwing a drone up there, and getting eyes on. I think that micro-terrain analysis really hyper-enabled our targeting efforts and our ability to kill so much of the Op4 there.
To jump back into the UAS platoon real quick, as you talk about that mission analysis that you did, understanding where you were going to want to do launch and recovery, and then understanding how you were going to want to approach your target areas, whether they were NAIs, just other information collection requirements. What kind of protection did you apply in order to make sure that those UAS platoons were safe when you were going to have them operating at those limited locations?
So what we typically did was we would set up ourselves roughly 500 meters to a click behind a company on the flot, and we would use them as our protection. Mostly because the idea was that while the companies are fighting it out, we have time to pack up and leave and conduct those survivability moves. We were more focused on flying rather than protecting, I guess, ourselves.
From a fire support coordination point, we always put NFAs over OP locations, over the drone locations, over any command post location. We got into the defense and we were putting critical friendly zones and call for fire zones deep.
Let's talk about the differences in either offensive operations versus defensive operations. What were some things that changed about the way you either used the UAS platoon or adjusted your targeting processes?
I'll start with offensive operations. The first one, as we maneuvered east to west through that southern corridor, and it's very similar to a movement to contact. You're trying to make as much ground as quickly as you can to set conditions for that culminating attack. And to enable that movement and that quick movement, we kept drones up as much as possible and as forward as possible to give that warning to the companies as they push forward. And if we could hit that enemy before the companies encounter them, all the better. We used drones to best set conditions. And then during our calming attack, you know, as part of that offensive bin there, putting drones up over the objective, trying to shape the objective as much as possible. And really, we're not to fly drones as well. We didn't want to tip our hand to the direction we intended to attack our culminating objective. You know, offsetting our launch recovery sites, offsetting those drone flight paths so that we did not inadvertently, you know, tell that for which direction we're coming from. And as far as defensive operations go, especially with the launch recovery sites where we're relatively static, so giving some thought to rapidly positioning them behind our flot so that the enemy couldn't target them themselves. And then identifying the enemy's scheme maneuver, where they were going to hit us, what was their feint, what was their main effort, and gaining positive identification of their massed effort, because that was breach our line so that we could have tripped them before they were able to breach or exploit that breach.
So from the targeting aspect, I talked about it earlier on, and we were talking about known, likely, and suspected LRP points and reconstitution points. As the formation was moving, we were making sure that essentially our battalion mortars were in position, ready to fire at all times, and we tried to bound the sections accordingly so that we could keep that tempo, especially in the offense. Then we got more dynamic once the drone platoon was on ground. We weren't using our forward observers as much as we would typically use them. We mainly focused on UAS being that assess piece and our sensor, our primary sensor, for anything that was in the battle space. Then when it came to the defense, targeting was really focused on those key intersection points where we can mass our organic system, really pinpoint them into that kill zone and move them into where we could get an effective Carl G shot or an AP shot. The primary focus for fires in the defense was not to destroy or neutralize. It was more to fix and turn so that we can get those vehicles and get those formations into a maneuver kill box so that we could be more effective with our AP systems.
Another thought occurred to me. So we quickly realized when we got to JRTC that we were going to be under constant observation. The Op4 there has just a plethora of different sets of capabilities. So we couldn't really move too far or anywhere on the battlefield without being seen. But to counter that, we just decided to move fast and increase our tempo. And when we did that, that forced us to shorten our kill chain. Because if we maintain that legacy kill chain of every targeting decision has to go up through multiple echelons, our fire's architecture would just not be able to respond at the pace we were pushing our maneuver. We gave our HAC commander, an O3 commander, a lot of authority to action that battalion-level kill chain themselves. We apportioned that HAC commander approximately a third of battalion-level munitions, and then we gave him the battalion commander's high-priority target list and said, if you see this, you shoot it. You don't need to request. So everything in front of our rapid movement was at HAC commanders to shoot. And the drone platoon falls under our HAC, so that commander had a habitual relationship with that platoon as well. So Lieutenant McDonald's KP's drone operator would see something, they would give it to their HAC commander, that's one hop, and then that HAC commander would call his mortar platoon and say, shoot it. And that was as short as it became. That takes a level of comfort on the battalion commanders and the battalion FSO's part, you know, to trust that subordinate commander to make those decisions. But getting our fires out forward as quickly as possible, essentially shoot to move, helped us move across the box that much faster.
Coming out of this rotation, what are the processes that you may have changed within your battalion based on the things that you learned from that training event that will feed into your preparedness to fight in the next fight?
Two big points I would like to make. The first is part of the reason we left 400 targets on the table was because we couldn't kill them before they displaced. So something that we've applied emphasis to after our rotation is building a true multifunctional drone platoon. So the field of capability that we had at JRTC was purely ISR. We attached it some droppable munitions and we had the sign off to do some one-way attack with them. But I'd say 95% of our employment of those specific drone systems was as an ISR platform to enable the kill from an indirect system. If we had the ability to see it and kill it right there, either with a single system or in a hunter-killer construct, we would have been able to do a lot more damage. So since JRTC rotation, we've tried to make that platoon very multifunctional. So we've invested a lot of time and effort in aerial EW detection to augment that full motion video detection. We've also been developing in-house solutions to FPV, first-person viewer, and one-way attack systems. We've advanced our airdrop munition capability as well. The other point I'll make is, the voice comms was just not sufficient to pass the targeting information at the speed that we needed to actually kill the enemy. We've gone much more towards a digital fire solution using emerging capabilities. What we've had success in since leaving JRTC is bringing that full motion video that those drones offer into a cloud computing environment and actually being able to see it. So anyone with access to that environment, whether they're at the forward line of troops and they're one of Jared's fire observers, or they're an S2 person sitting in our main command post, can see what that drone operator is seeing. We'd like to take that even a step further and apply AI tools so that those can reside in that cloud environment. Essentially, the AI tool sees a tank and it knows a tank, and so it tells us that that's a tank. If we've been able to network the drones and get that sensor data from the drone into that cloud computing environment, the next step then is networking the mortars at the battalion level or the artillery systems at the brigade level so that we can pass that data seamlessly through a digital pathway from sensor to shooter.
Sir, this is the first one is being able to train the drone operator essentially on what exactly they're looking at. Because at the end of the day, a drone operator is going to see a tank or a high payoff target, and they're going to immediately send that A-digit grid. Answer a couple of questions for the battalion FSO. What is it? What are they doing? How many are there? What weapon systems? The second thing, we need to lean in heavily on that Ditto Fires communication piece. The amount of transmissions that came through my radio was overwhelming at points. Like, I had a dedicated amount of pieces of scrap paper in my laminated battle book that was filled every single day with grids, with target descriptions, with rounds that were shot. And if we are able to move forward into that cloud-based server and pull that information with what we're trying to lean forward on, and AI and detecting what we're seeing and building our common operating picture, it would be significantly easier to target, and it would be a lot faster. If a drone operator sees a tank, it is pulled up into our cloud system, pushed into the common operating picture, and then that can be sifted up at the battalion level if I'm away for whatever reason, and it can be pushed to the brigade for prosecution, and we can focus on our battalion fight and what we can actually affect in our battle space.
Sergeant Jameson, I have two things to add. The first one is kind of how we integrate these robotic systems into our existing engagement and strike frameworks. So on one hand, we have the legacy man-portable system, specifically for AT. We're talking AT-4s, Carl G's, Javelins, things that we need to be eyes on with an enemy target that is also more than likely in our engagement range, and we are in their engagement range. And then on the other hand, we have our indirect assets, be it 60s, 81s, 120s, 119ers, or 777s, or anything above that echelon, sir. Kind of how we fit in things like purpose-built attritable system platforms, FPV, what I would like to call one-way attack light, and then one-way attack heavy, which is Switchblade or something like Hero 120. It's not a replacement for these systems. It's still going to take several FPV-style drones to disable a BMP. It's not going to replace the guy on the line humping a Carl G down the road or down the wood line. And in the same sense, sir, like, a Switchblade or a Hero 120 isn't going to replace a battery of 155s that can rain God's wrath upon a given area. On the other hand, sir, like Captain Rooney said, the massive data that having a dedicated UAS section provides, my 162 got so hot that it melted my assault pack just due to the breadth and the density of transmissions. But having a dedicated staff process, whether that's someone who's constantly on the digital cop updating enemy positions, fire missions, things of that nature, or whether it's a subnet or subtask of the staff functions, to where there's a representative from fires, there's a representative from S2, and there's a representative from movement and maneuver who work to synthesize all this data into something that's useful for the fires community, that can get reported up to brigade, and that can also get pushed down to the subordinate commanders.
Okay, did you have anything internal, Sergeant Kirkpatrick, you wanted to talk about process improvements?
Really, the two big things that I would like to hit on, integrating the EW system immediately off the rip into our platoon. A big thing that we lacked the first 2 days was kind of direction. It was, hey, we know kind of where the enemy's at, go in that area. Our guys were really just kind of flying around, not really knowing what they're looking for, not really knowing a distance or direction, or even a description, really. And the EW showed up day two in the box, and they're like, hey, this is who we are, this is what we do. And I was like, okay, awesome. Basically what they could do, kind of zone us in on like that distance and or direction. It really kind of gave insight to our operators. It drastically dropped wasted time for us. Hey, this is what you're looking for, this is our best guess, and this is kind of the distance and direction which we think that it is. And just integrating that system out of the gate would have probably gave us another 40 targets that we could have destroyed or taken off the board. And lastly, a real big takeaway that I would like to discuss is finding the right guys for the job. We were often described as a pickup basketball team, but thankfully I was given dudes who were immensely smart at the job, right? They were incredible operators and they all had amazing critical thinking skills. I didn't really have to constantly be over their shoulders and saying, hey, what are you guys finding? When you think about your UAS operators, you don't necessarily need the strongest guys. You need the smart guys. You need those soldiers who grew up playing Xbox on their controllers, that hand-eye coordination. Those soldiers who can think and find the answers to the problems outside of the box, because that's what this job inherently is it's how can I get the best outcome on a situation that I don't know what I'm rolling into until I'm there. You need those guys that have that critical thinking skill and find a solution to the problem that we immediately faced in a flash. And I think that's really where I would like to drive home.
We'll kind of look outside of your organization to the bigger Army. If you could reach out to Army leadership and ask for one thing to be changed that would better enable you, whether it's from a training perspective or a material perspective or a doctrine perspective going forward.
Yeah, so this is Lucas, Brigade and below. I really need AI-enabled kill chains. Currently, our efforts on that front have been solely in-house. We've been fielded some equipment, some Army Programs of Record equipment to assist us in the sensing portion of that. Obviously, we have our indirect shooters, etc. But the in-between piece, the digital pathways, the AI tools necessary to really improve our lethality at scale, fielding those kill chain enabling technologies and systems would definitely help.
Okay. Captain Rooney?
We as a fires community are lacking in is upgrades necessary to keep up with the maneuver. When we look at the field artillery, we are still operating under the legacy system. Our howitzers are not being fielded or upgraded essentially with the new ITAN systems. The sleds that the howitzers are pulling are still your regular ASIPs. We do have some of the ITN systems, however, they're not at the guns. We need to continue to evolve with the current maneuver force and where the Army is going.
Okay, Lieutenant McDonald.
In the 82nd Airborne as a division, we've already completed at least one brigade fully transitioning to the mobile brigade concept and transitioning to HHC being split into the MPC and the headquarters section. And in that headquarters section, there lives an integration cell. As it sits right now in the current RSTRUC and in the MBCT construct, UAS capability is primarily housed in the multifunctional reconnaissance company. We in Devil Brigade, 1st Brigade, 82nd, have chosen to cut the cake a little bit differently. And instead of housing the capability in the MFRC, we've essentially devved out the UAS integration cell into a platoon level headquarters that lives in the current HHC, the future MPC, and is fully integrated purely in support of the battalion's objectives with short range one way attack and short range reconnaissance up to what I would call a high group one or a low group two UAS level. Something that has VTOL capability but has extended endurance of up to, you know, 2 hours. As it sits right now, that would look something like the MFRC houses the brigade's UAS section with dedicated long-range reconnaissance, with dedicated 15-series operators and a 150-series warrant in charge of that section. But then each of the line battalions would receive that platoon-level headquarters, and they would be responsible for not only collection at the battalion level, as well as targeting with the fires community, but also fielding those systems like PBAS or HERO 120 here coming down the line to put 11 series with an additional duty or who are serving as dedicated drone operators closer to the flot. And if need be, I can detach one of my teams right now and send them through the breach with a rifle company. It's not something that many of us are comfortable doing with a new 15 X-ray or a 15 whiskey who doesn't necessarily have that on the ground experience. For instance, like in my platoon, all of our operators are 11 Bravos who have spent time on the line, who understand how to shoot, move, and communicate, and above all, they're infantrymen. If we're going to put systems like PBAS that have reduced range of a click to three clicks, roughly, it makes more sense for us to put infantrymen closer to the point of contact, sir. I'm not saying to completely do away with the RSTRUC, but to necessarily say the battalion will hold the MRR assets as well as the short-range and one-way attack assets, and then the brigade holds long-range reconnaissance akin to what Shadow provided historically.
Before I pass it off to Staff Sergeant Kirkpatrick, I want to kind of follow up, and this is kind of for both of you in the UAS platoon, because you had the discussion about talent management. When you look at that talent management, are either of you concerned about the number and types of UASs that are available and stretching the ability for those operators to be able to move seamlessly between different organizations on their career paths.
The diversification of systems across the Army, in some ways akin to how the fires community operates, sir. The Army says, you will get this capability. It is an M777 howitzer. It fires this round at this range. We have programs of record within the Army, SRR, Tranche 1 and Tranche 2, Black Widow and Skydio. We have PBAS on the way. We have things like Switchblade, where the Army has fielded us a standard capability across the formation. But where I think diversification of systems is necessary is us at the 82nd, we fight similar but different to how 101 fights. But within the 18th Airborne Corps, we largely fight the same way, with the exception of, say, 3rd ID. 3rd ID being a heavy force, they have more vehicles. They have the ability to recharge. They have the ability to carry weight. So the systems that, for what I do here at the 82nd, might not be best suited for what 3rd ID does, even just internal to the 18th Airborne Corps. When we talk training management in terms of system to system, many of these systems, they essentially fly themselves. It's not very difficult to take, you know, a standard off-the-line infantryman to say, hey, here's 3 days, do your buck one and buck two online, your online preliminary requirements. And then we can actually teach you over the course of 3 days. So I don't see it as a huge impact that we have many different types of systems. I think where we start running into issues with diversification of systems is when we start getting up to those group 3 and above aircraft that require more robust airspace management, more robust charging requirements, more robust personnel requirements. Group 1 and below, with the exception of FPVs, largely fly themselves.
I believe, like you said, all of the systems that we fly right now, albeit not the FPV, all pretty much fly themselves. You don't have to worry. You're not thinking in that 3D space. I think that it easily translates across the board. Where it's going to get hard is, like you said, it's just unit SOP of how they set up their own stations and how they use them throughout the force.
Okay, gentlemen, this was a great discussion today. Thank you for sharing your insights. Would you have a final lesson learned that you want to provide to our audience today?
My advice for future rotational units at JRTC, you know, we made a lot of mistakes, really our share of mistakes. I think if we had done it perfectly, we would have left there and not attempted to continue to develop out our own internal system processes. So, you know, I'm actually, quite honestly, happy that we failed it so much, because it really drove us to prove ourselves coming out. The lead up to JRTC is just as important and probably even more important than how you perform at JRTC, because that is where you're going to integrate and synchronize your various capabilities. Moving as far forward on that terrain analysis, talking to others that have gone through the box, ideally as recently as possible, you know, will really pay dividends in helping you build understanding. And then given some serious thought to how you want to organize for success, you know, making those decisions early and integrating those decisions will pay dividends.
Sir, so final comment for my side of the house. Talked a little bit about it, but what I'd like to really drive home is like that integration with drones in every facet of the fire support community. Just getting them cross-trained on what exactly we do as fire supporters and getting them to understand that help fire transmission and understanding what those 15 subsequent corrections are and giving them that knowledge. Being able to integrate them into our battalion mortar certification, get them into Cable 6s, which is our howitzer certifications, getting them to observe live rounds, and building that relationship is imperative. That is the formation that we'll be talking to, and being able to build that rapport with the SUAS platoon leader or drone operator and giving them the confidence to call for fire and having them know what they're actually talking about is super critical.
So I'd just like to drive home the importance of layering systems by type and capability, sir. What we call the layered ISR strike architecture, having at the battalion level, having a medium range reconnaissance asset that provides some endurance and some longevity in the battle space, and then being able to do hunter-killer pairing with SRR and one-way attack style platforms. It's something that we've seen Ukraine do for the longest time. It's the most efficient way, most effective way to utilize these systems, sir.
One thing that I think would be the biggest takeaway from all of this is integrating your UAS into all of your training events. That's what we do here. Immediately following JRTC, it came out as a statement from our VC of, hey, you will integrate no matter what it is, squad and up, into your sticks lanes, your live fires, things of that nature. I think the biggest takeaway with that is it's getting soldiers used to hearing the sounds of a UAS, knowing what to do. Because when you look at our JRTC, anytime that there was red air, it would be a, hey, does this belong to us? I'm just gonna stand out here in the open. And that was a big thing with like what we saw from the enemy as well, is they would just stand there. There was no overhead cover, there was nothing like that. So I think the biggest takeaway is for everybody who's listening is start integrating UAS into your everyday planning. It'll pay dividends moving forward for, hey, I know that they're going to be using UAS. What is something that we do here? How do we integrate our UAS into our training? Oh, let's look at overhead cover. Let's move our vehicles off the road into the wood line just to get away from the natural points of drift of our systems. That would be my biggest takeaway, is just start integrating your systems now, because it will pay dividends when you move down to JRTC and your soldiers are under constant threat of the UAS.
Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us and sharing your insights. Today, we discussed lessons learned about UAS integration and targeting as executed by members of the 2nd Battalion 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment. You can find call resources available by going to www.army.mil/call, our CAC-enabled site. There, you may download products and request print products shipped to you. For more insights into topics discussed, see CALL's Ukraine Sprint Report, First-Person Video, Tactical and Technical Lessons from Ukraine, and Forging the Future Force. Additionally, you can find articles and best practices from units by using the Quickfire Portal. If you have trouble finding information on our website, use the Request for Information tab and receive direct feedback from an analyst at CALL. Finally, if you have a best practice to submit or a capability gap that requires a .mil PF solution, submit observations directly to CALL using the Quickfire Portal on our website. Be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast and follow us on social media. I would like to thank all of our CALL team members, and a special thanks to Major Joe Perez and Mr. Alex Brasco, who attended the AIR Summit and are currently working on UAS products for our audiences. As always, thanks to Ms. Paige Cox for her excellent support in producing this podcast. We are dedicated to providing you with the insights you need to lead, train, and fight today and in the future. Join us next time for another discussion on lessons learned from the force.